We're up to the eighth commandment now, so eighth, ninth, and tenth, 3 weeks left of this series. And we're in the section of the Ten Commandments that contains the shall nots. That's probably the part of the Ten Commandments that most people think of when they think of them. And what we talked about with these shall nots is that a prohibition, a shall not, is always given to protect something beautiful. Just like the art museum says you shall not touch these paintings because we want to protect the beauty of these paintings ultimately so that you can enjoy them more in the long run, God gives shall nots or prohibitions to protect something beautiful. And the first one he gives is that you shall not murder because he believes human life is beautiful and he wants to protect that. The next was that you shall not commit adultery because marriage is a beautiful thing that God has created and he wants to protect that. And today we're going to see that God wants to protect the gifts that he has generously given to some, what we could call property. And therefore, the prohibition we're looking at today is the prohibition against stealing. Now, this is one of those commandments like murder that can be easy to kind of gloss over. Like you hear it and take a deep breath and you're like, ah, good, I don't do that. But like the sermon on murder, once you start to consider the implications of what God is really saying in this, I think you'll find that it does challenge us in some unique ways. To give you an example, a 2008 study in the journal Science by Elizabeth Dunn reported that she and her team of researchers had found that those who give away more of what they have experience consistently higher levels of happiness than those who even make more. So, you know, the conventional wisdom is the higher income leads to higher happiness, but what they are finding is the higher giving actually leads to higher happiness. But if you're anything like me, when you sit down to consider giving, and I'm talking about giving in such a way that it might actually change your lifestyle a little bit, that it might actually mean some sacrifice on your part, it doesn't feel like the path to happiness, right? It feels like the exact opposite. Like these questions start to flood into your mind, right? Like, how am I going to make ends meet if I do this? How will I provide for my needs? But that means I won't get to whatever that may be. What about my desires? I did work for this, after all. And these questions, while not altogether undesirable, are the very questions that can make stealing seem desirable and can make it even seem justifiable in some ways. They can lead us to take rather than give, which ironically actually prevents us from walking the path to happiness, the path that Jesus laid out when he himself said, "It is more blessed to give than to receive." And the path that you yourself have probably experienced and which study after study on happiness continues to point out to us is the genuine path to happiness. Yet this is not the way that God intended it to be. God himself is a gracious and generous giver. And he gives some things to some and different things to others. And his desire is to protect those good and beautiful gifts that he has given to his people. Therefore, you shall not steal. And today we're going to look at what stealing is, we'll look at why we do it, and we'll look at how God responds to it. Okay, so the passage of scripture we're looking at, we've already quoted it. This is another one of those really long readings, so get your seatbelt on. Exodus 20, verse 15, you shall not steal. Okay, good. So what's the important interpretive question for this verse? What does it mean to steal, right? That's pretty much the only one before us. I'm guessing you know what shall not means. It means don't do it. But what does it mean to steal? Well, the general definition or the conventional definition of stealing is the unauthorized taking of something that belongs to another. Unauthorized taking of something that belongs to another. So there's actually a profound implication of this. God is affirming the idea that there are certain things that belong to someone and not to others. He's affirming the concept of property and upholding it. That the goods that you have are not generally the goods of your society, but they do actually belong to you in some unique way. Now, some of you say, well, isn't that obvious? We all kind of get that. Not everyone believes that, actually, though. There have been philosophers throughout history that have questioned whether we should even uphold the idea of private property. Plato, in some ways, messed with this. Karl Marx famously said that the theory of the communists may be summed up in the single phrase, abolition of private property. Right, so he's saying that the best society is one in which goods are not owned by any individual or family, but they are spread out and distributed in the society. So stealing is not really a thing, because basically it belongs to all of us. So God is contradicting that here. God is saying, no, there is actually such a concept of private property. But God also modifies the concept of private property in a significant way. Because throughout the Bible, God is actually seen as the ultimate owner of everything. So Psalm 24:1, for example, be on the screen behind me here. It says, "The earth is the Lord's and the fullness thereof, the world and those who dwell therein." See, the same way when an artist creates a piece of art, the assumption is that's their art until they sell it or give the rights to someone else. Everything God creates is God's possession, and God made everything. So the world, the people in it, all the goods and possessions of it belong ultimately to God. We could think of it as everything is ultimately God's private property. It belongs to him. And yet, God is also this gracious, generous giver who takes of the things that belong to him and entrusts them to us, entrusts them to people. Like, just think about that. God doesn't have to do that, right? It's all his. He can just say, I'm not going to give you anything. And somehow he gives us our basic necessities, food, drink, water, air. And then on top of that, he gives you other cool things. Like last night, I got to go to the Sixers-Cavs game down at the Wells Fargo Arena. I was thinking, sports, like, God gives us sports. It's meaningless. It's silly stuff. I love it, right? It's entertaining. It's fun. But they're just throwing a ball around. And God has actually generously given the freedom for people to get to enjoy things like that. And if you're a Sixers fan, it's less enjoyable. But last night, we got close. You know, 5 turnovers at the end, whatever. But we almost beat LeBron, so that was cool. Anyway, God gives us good gifts, right? He's this generous, gracious giver. And yet, it's still true that God gives certain gifts to some and different gifts to others. But he gives them not as a transferring of ultimate ownership. He gives them so as stewards. The concept of a steward is someone who manages the property of another. So a steward is given a genuine measure of authority over it, right? If you have money, you are given the authority to spend it. But they're also ultimately responsible to the one who owns it, and responsible to carry it out in the way that owner would want them to use it. So we're not saying people have their own stuff and you better let them hold on to their money and let them use it however they want because that's what they have the right to do. God actually says, no, you're given that freedom, you're given the ability to do that, but you're responsible to the ultimate owner. We're responsible to God. That's what the principle of stewardship is showing us. So if we want to modify our definition of stealing, we could do it this way. Stealing is the unauthorized taking of something God has entrusted to another. So no one's the ultimate owner of anything they have. I'm not the ultimate owner of anything I have. You're not either. And yet, God has entrusted certain things to me that he hasn't entrusted to you, and he's entrusted certain things to you that he hasn't entrusted to me. And stealing is when I look at something God's entrusted to another, and I take it and make it my own. So what are some common ways this happens? Well, for the Israelites, they were farmers for the most part. It was an agricultural society. And so one of the most common laws that's repeated throughout the Old Testament is that you're not supposed to take your neighbor's animals. You're not supposed to take their livestock. Because for them, animals meant money. Animals meant business. They also meant food on the table, right? Because they would literally have to raise their own animals and eat them. They didn't have the same kind of availability of fresh foods that we have in the 21st century here in America. And so it was very tempting to take that and claim it for themselves. Another thing that it meant for the Israelites is that they were not to take workers for themselves. And so again, throughout the Old Testament, one of the things that's commonly prohibited is that you're not to take a person and claim them as your own in the process of slavery. And so this is also prohibiting what would have been common in America at a certain time period. The American slave trade has always been forbidden by Scripture because it required the taking of a person and claiming them as your own. And unfortunately, while we would like to think that's a thing of the past, through all forms of human trafficking, which still happen underground through the U.S., and which happen in more above-ground ways throughout the country, this is still a sad reality of our world and an industry that pulls in millions every year. So God prohibits the taking of animals. He prohibits the taking of people. Now, some of you are already guilty, right? But I'm guessing there's not that many of you in the room who are struggling with, you know, ox stealing. And so what does this have to say to us today? Well, we can think about some ways that the relationships we're in may involve theft. Think about your roommates or your housemates, for example. How often do you take things from them without their permission? When I thought about myself, this was one that came up for me. Sometimes my wife and I will have snacks or desserts or something that we know we're kind of supposed to share. But sometimes I want to finish them off, man. I want seconds or thirds. And so in small ways, I can just take from her. Or my housemates, for example. We kind of have my wife and I live with another couple. And we have an arrangement where there's a general sense of generosity. If something's left over, hey, it's fair game. But sometimes there's not that much of it left over. And you know if you take it, they're not going to get any of it. And sometimes I'll just feel the freedom to do that, right? And to go ahead and take from them. So this is small, right? But there's something happening there in an attitude that matters and that actually can build distrust over time. It could be taking your roommate's or housemate's clothing without permission. It could be taking actual money from them, withholding a rent payment or a payment for the cable bill or the electric bill or whatever it may be, withholding something that's rightfully theirs, also stealing from them. Another one is that in our time period, we're more aware of the need for intellectual property and copyright laws. So we're not as much dealing in animals and in livestock. We're dealing more in information, right? That tends to be a commodity of our time period. And so there's certain things that when people produce, they have proprietary rights over, such as a song or a movie, for example. And so when we take those things without permission, usually through some kind of purchase transaction, that's also an act of stealing. When we take credit for something that we haven't actually done, plagiarism, or even in your workplace, you know, a product is put out or a project is accomplished and you take the credit for it, when in fact you know that it was your coworker who actually put in the time and the work, you're stealing from the reward that rightfully belongs to them and taking it for yourself. Time is a resource and a commodity in our busy generation. You can steal time from others. Stealing time from your family is maybe one of the easiest ways to do this. So you just don't give time to spending with your spouse or your children because you're busy working or doing something else for yourself. Or you're present with them in that time, but you're not really present. So having a conversation with your spouse and still just thinking about work, spending time with your kids but still just mostly screwing around on your phone, TV shows on, can't be distracted. That's time that you're taking away from people that you actually relationally owe something to. Time can also be stolen from an employer. So when you become an employee of a company, that company is entrusted with that time. You're contracted to be giving that to them. So when you use company time for personal things like social media or checking your personal email or getting caught up on your home tasks, you're actually stealing that time from your employer. And this is actually a major problem in the U.S. So Phil Ryken, who used to be a pastor at 10th Presbyterian down the street, he's the president of Wheaton College now, he said this: employee theft of time and property costs American businesses and their investors more than $200 billion per year. According to some estimates, as much as one-third of a product's cost goes to cover the various forms of stealing that occur on its way to the marketplace. This theft surcharge, as analysts call it, is a drag on our whole economy. I mean, think about that. You go buy a $9 product. That's saying that up to $3 of that product that's coming out of your pocket now is just because so many people stole along the way from the time that thing was an idea to the time it actually got manufactured. So that's stealing of time. It's also stealing of goods. Like if you work for a company and you just take things and use them for personal use. Like when I used to work at a giant food store before I became a Christian, I became a seafood expert because I was stealing the seafood from the seafood department frequently and I was trading it with the guy in the bakery for the donuts. You know, okay. Feels like a small thing, but it's, again, you add all that up and now your $9 product used to be $6 and everybody's paying an extra $3 for it. Governments exist in some ways to make sure this kind of thing doesn't happen, right? To regulate this, and it's good and appropriate that governments guard private property from being stolen. However, governments have to collect taxes in order to do that, and we steal from the government when we lie on our taxes or withhold money that we rightfully owe to them, not report certain streams of income that we have taken. Jesus says himself, give to Caesar those things that are Caesar's and to God those things that are God's. He's acknowledging there are certain things that belong to Caesar and we owe them to him. So something you can kind of notice through this is that this can come out in a lot of different relationships and in a lot of different directions. And usually we, depending on our background, we think of stealing as coming primarily either from those who are in power or from those who are under power. So we think the government is the ones who are ultimately stealing from us when they raise our taxes through the roof, or we think employees are the ones that are always stealing from their employers when they blow off work hours. But it runs in both directions, really. Like, employers can also steal from their employees when they make them work crazy kinds of hours because they say, well, you're on a salary and your job is just to get the work done, and so I can just make you work whenever I want to make you work, but not actually pay them adequately for the work that they are doing. An employer can say to employees, based on supply and demand, that if I can pay you less, I'm going to pay you less. I don't care if it's a fair wage or not. On the flip side, labor unions can get together and refuse to work unless they get a higher wage that isn't actually fair for the thing that they're doing. I'm not taking a position on the current SEPTA strike as to which one of those things are happening. I honestly don't know, but I'm sure it's, you know, one of those things at least is involved, this desire to have when it hasn't actually been given. And certain political persuasions tend to say those who are in power are the bad guys, those who are under power are the bad guys, but God doesn't play favorites. He just sees this is a human problem. And if you're in power, you want to stay in power, so you'll steal from the people under you. And if you're under power, you want to be in power, so you'll steal from those who are. That being said, it's really good news, actually, that God doesn't play favorites, because the world usually does. And it's still the case that the poor are one of the easiest targets for theft. Because while the poor don't have much, they also don't have many ways to fight back. Most poor people can't afford the kind of legal recourse, you know, the fancy defense lawyer who could come in and take care of a grievance that they might have. Many poor people live in neighborhoods where police response times are significantly lower than they are for wealthier neighborhoods, so it's easier to commit theft and not be caught in those environments. Credit companies often prey on the poor by charging exorbitant interest rates because they know these people need this money or they're not going to be able to make their housing payments. In some ways, universities have become part of this. They'll take poor teenagers who don't know any better and say, hey, we're this small liberal arts college that costs $40,000 a year, and we can get you a fancy degree that'll never get you a job, but you'll get $120,000 of debt when you come out. That's stealing, right? That's preying on the weak. But not only that, God actually views when those of us who have excessive money, money above and beyond our basic needs, keep all that for ourselves and don't give it to the poor, God views that as stealing. Now that's different on a conventional definition of stealing, right? If stealing is just the unauthorized taking of something that belongs to another, you say, no, I'm not doing that. I'm just keeping what belongs to me. I've earned it, right? But if stealing is taking the things God has entrusted to another, if you keep things that God actually intends to entrust to someone else, that's stealing. So for example, in the Old Testament law, when someone owned a field, they were only allowed to harvest their crops up to a certain point, and they had to leave the rest of the harvest for the poor to come and gather. Now, if they harvested right up to the edge and took all of it for themselves, they would have been stealing the things that God had entrusted to give to the poor, even though technically it was their property. Think of it this way. A father has four kids, and he sends them down to Reading Terminal Market, gives them $50, and says to the oldest son, I'm going to give you the $50 in cash, and I want you to buy lunch for yourself and for your siblings. But the oldest son's walking down Broad Street, getting ready to go down to the market, and walks right past Arch, just keeps on going, hangs a right on Chestnut, goes over to Fogo de Chão, right? And he decides, hey, all-you-can-eat Brazilian steakhouse, that sounds pretty good. $50, gets himself an all-you-can-eat Brazilian lunch, his siblings starve. It was his money, right? Like the father gave it to him, it was in his possession. But it wasn't ultimately his money, right? He was actually stealing from his siblings because his father had given him that money with the intention that he would give it to his siblings who were in need. But who did he ultimately steal from? He didn't ultimately steal from his siblings, he ultimately stole from his father. Because it was his father's money in the first place, and his father had given it to him to steward for a specific purpose. And that's what's really behind all of our stealing. All of our stealing is ultimately stealing from God, because it's all taking something that's actually owned by God that he has entrusted for something else and claiming it for our own purposes. Now, there are specific ways that the Bible points out stealing from God happening kind of more directly. The most common one is when we don't give our money generously to the work of the church and God's mission in the world. Like Malachi 3, you can go read it. God actually says, you are robbing me by withholding the money that should have been dedicated to the work of the temple and of God's people and keeping it for yourself. This isn't a pitch for you to give more to City Light Church necessarily or whatnot. I'm just saying this is one of the things that God points out is stealing or taking from him. But really, it's behind all of our stealing. And that's why it's serious, okay? If you're anything like me, some of the examples I've shared have kind of felt like, come on, man, really? Like, we all take some stuff from our roommates sometimes. We all pirate the occasional movie or music. We all just blow off work for an hour sometimes. You kind of have to, right? But this is why it's serious in God's sight, okay? Because all that stuff ultimately belongs to him. And if he hasn't entrusted it to you, he hasn't entrusted it to you. It's not actually yours to use. It all belongs to him. And when we take it and claim it for ourselves, we're saying to God, I don't trust you. I don't trust you with what you've provided. I don't trust you with who you've entrusted it to. I'm going to take it, and I'm going to use it, and I'm going to keep it for myself. So why do we do that? Well, this gives us a hint into it, and this is the second point we're going to talk about. Why this is so tempting, despite the fact that, again, studies suggest that it's not actually the best path to happiness. Well, first, we tend to think we know what we need, and we don't trust anyone else to give it to us. So if you're the oldest brother, and your father gives you $50 and says, hey, buy yourself a meal at the market, buy some for your siblings, what's he saying when he goes to Fogo de Chao? He's saying, I know what I need. That meal at the market, not good enough. I'm going to take what I need, and I know I can provide it. So also, when we steal from a roommate, let's say, what are we saying? We're saying, I know what I need, and I can trust myself to provide it. We're even in some measure saying, since I'm so much more important than this other person, it just makes sense that I would have this and they wouldn't. We're viewing ourselves as more significant than the people that God has placed around us. When we withhold our money from the poor, we're saying, I know who really needs this money, and it's me. And therefore, I'm going to make sure that I hold on to it tightly and keep it for myself. See, it's a scary thing to be needy, and we do live in a world where we are, right? Like, it's just a reality that if you receive nothing, if nothing is provided for you, you won't last long, right? Try living without food and shelter for a time period. It doesn't go well. But the conclusion we draw from that is only I can be trusted to take care of me. There is no God who's out there who could actually watch over me and care for me, so I better fill in. I better step in and be God, and then I can make sure that I'm taken care of. And if we're thinking of ourselves as functionally God, then we're going to feel entitled to the things that God is only entitled to. So God is the owner of everything. We'll feel like I'm the owner of everything. And therefore, if someone else has something and I want it, it's mine to take. We'll feel like we have the ability to keep everything, and we'll feel like we have the ability to use the things that we do have the way that we want to use them. So we want to be the ultimate owner and the ultimate authority. So not only is it mine, but I'm not a steward of it under God. I get to use it for the purposes I want to use it for. I want to own everything. So when I look at my family and I think about my time, I say, this is my time. I don't want to feel constrained to have to give my time and give up what I want to do with it to spend time with my spouse or with my kids and engage in an honest conversation with them. I want to keep everything. The government thinks they should be able to get their hands on taxes or whatnot. No, they didn't earn that. That's mine. I'm going to hold on to it and I'm going to keep it. I want to use it how I see fit. My employer has ideas for how they want me to use this time. I don't think those ideas are very good. So I'm going to use it for what I want to use it for and use this company time for personal use or for something that I haven't actually been assigned to do. This attitude results in a taking attitude. I take rather than give, and it actually gets in the way of us being truly happy, being able to become the kind of people who can generously give things away. You just can't do it as long as you think there is no God. And therefore, I better become God and be trusted with the ultimate care of my own life and my own soul and determining my own needs. So how does God respond to that? How does God handle it? That's the third thing that we'll close by considering. Well, think about it. If you gave a gift to your children, to one of your kids, because you cared about them, you loved them, and you wanted them to be able to enjoy it, and then someone came in and stole it, like how would you feel about that, right? Like, you would feel a good and righteous anger, like a desire to protect this good thing that you have given to your child. Like, if you were the kind of parent who gave that good gift to your kid and it got stolen and you just said, hey, whatever, suck it up, man. No one would look at you and say, what a great parent. Aren't they loving and forgiving? No, they would say, this person's not loving. Like, they must not care. And so also, God cares. God is not this indifferent, removed God who doesn't care when things that are entrusted to specific people are taken by others. He has a desire to defend this, and therefore judgment. There is a punishment, there is a penalty that falls on thieves. And governments have enforced this through most of human history. Where this is not enforced, no society has ever truly flourished. And that's actually a good thing that governments have done. In the first century, you could actually, there were certain kinds of theft that you could be killed for, that you could receive the death penalty for. And there's a story in the gospel accounts of two men who are actually being crucified specifically for theft. That's the crime that these two men were guilty of. But between them was Jesus Christ. Between them was the Son of God. And why was he there? He had never committed a theft in his life. You can read the gospel accounts. There's no stories of Jesus stealing from someone, and yet here he is receiving the punishment due to thieves, standing next, crucified next to two thieves who are getting, in a sense, exactly what they deserved. Well, Isaiah tells us in his prophecy of what the Messiah would be. This is what he says about the coming Messiah. He says, "He poured out his soul to death and was numbered with the transgressors. Yet he bore the sin of many and makes intercession for the transgressors." When Jesus is on the cross, he's being numbered with the thieves. He's being identified with the transgressors, being treated as one who had stolen, but not just from people, not just taking the government's penalty. He's being treated as one who had stolen ultimately from God, and he is receiving the judgment of God when he is on the cross. Think about what the thieves next to him needed most in that moment. If you're on a cross, if you're a thief, you're already guilty, right? What do you need most? You need some way to survive the judgment. And when the thief next to Jesus turns to him in faith, Jesus says to him, "Today, you will be with me in paradise." How could he say that to a thief, a genuine person who had stolen from people and stolen from God? He could say that because while he was on the cross, he was dying for that thief's sins. And he can say that to you today. If you will come to him in faith, that today you will be with him in paradise. Because he has died for your thievery as well. This is his promise to everyone who comes to him through faith, that you will be with him in paradise. He's seen your greatest need. If you're a thief, your greatest need is to be able to survive the judgment, and Jesus has taken it in your place so that you could be with him in paradise. How can you doubt God's provision for you? Like, how can you doubt that he knows what you need and he will provide it? He's seen your greatest need, and he's provided it. And not just by snapping his fingers, by going to the cross and paying the price that you actually owed. Another penalty for thievery in the Bible, another penalty for theft, is that you had to make restitution. You had to pay back three or four. How can you pay back theft against God? It costs you your life, and Jesus has given his life in your place so that you could experience paradise with him. If you have that, there's no way to doubt that this God is good, that this God will provide for your every need. Romans 8:32 says, "He who did not spare his own son, but gave him up for us all, how will he not also with him graciously give us all things?" He's already given his son for you. He's not withholding from you something that you need and holding it back. He's proven that. He's given the most precious thing that he has on your behalf so that you could have the thing that you need most. You don't have to be God. You don't have to own everything, keep everything, and use it how you see fit. You can let God be God because your greatest need has actually been taken care of. Last thing, if your greatest need has been taken care of, what does that do in you? Ephesians 4:28 shows us this. Ephesians 4:28, addressing people who have come to Jesus by faith, who have experienced this promise to be with him in paradise, it says this: "Let the thief no longer steal, but rather let him labor, doing honest work with his own hands, so that he may have something to share with anyone in need." If all your needs are already met, you don't have to take. And you can actually use that energy for something else. You can use it to give. First, we give when we work. Because all work, all noble work, all honest work, which is what this is talking about, so it's not talking about dishonest labor, but all honest work is ultimately done in service to someone else. That's why there's someone paying for it, right? That's why there's a market for it, because somebody says, "This would serve me if you would do this thing." So when you do your job, you are actually saying no to your desire to take, and you are giving of your time, of your energy, of your resources in order to bless and make the lives of others better, in order to love your neighbors. And so if you're done thinking, stealing is the ultimate opposite of work, right? Because work is a giving to someone else, stealing is a taking from someone else. If you're free from that, you can do honest work. But then you say, "Well, yeah, but I get paid too." I mean, that helps, you know, when you go to work and you get paid. So what do you do with the paycheck? Well, this also directs us to that. It's ultimately not for you to keep. It's not ultimately for you to have authority over. It's so that you may have something to share with anyone who's in need. So that you do this honest labor, and then God gives you what you need to do what is ultimately the path to true happiness, to give it away, to turn it around, and to give it to those who are in need. And when the Bible talks about giving, you can kind of think about what should I be giving to in terms of concentric circles. The first responsibility we have in giving away to those in need is giving to our family. Giving to a spouse if they're not working, or even if they are, you both share that responsibility to provide for one another. To give to your children who probably aren't working by the time they're two, and so they need someone to support them and to feed them. You're going to take the money that you worked hard for and give it away to people who didn't work for it, right? Because you don't need it. Because it's not yours. Because it belongs to God, and he's given it to you with a bigger purpose than just that you keep it and use it for whatever you want. Your ultimate needs are met. You're going to be with him in paradise. Just give it away. Just get rid of it, because you don't need it. You've got something better, and your neighbor does need it. Your family does need it. Next, outside of your family, is your church community, your church family. And so that means there's a priority in our giving to whatever local church we're a part of. So yes, if City Light's your home, that means City Light. But if it's not, no, I don't want you to give all your money here. That's not what we're after. Give it to the church that is your home, okay? But there's a priority in this giving to our church family, because the gospel, in order to go forward, has needs. We got to pay for this building. We got to pay for these instruments. These are all things that we do in order to see the gospel move forward and advance in our world. And so we give our money away to the church family and to the needs of the gospel going forward in the world. And then the third thing, but definitely not the last thing, is those outside of our community that are in need. So of course, the first poor people that you can give to are if there's poor in your family. And then, if there's poor in your church family. You know, again, it's kind of disingenuous of churches to have a church member sitting in the front row that we're not providing for, and then say, hey, but we're giving a lot to the community. No, you have to take care of the people that are part of your family, right? But it just doesn't end there. We live in what many people call the poorest big city in the U.S. There are needs in our city, and we as a church are intentionally considering together how we can be involved in the needs of the city. But it's going to involve those of us who have privilege, those of us who have access to money above and beyond our basic needs, to be generous in giving that money away to the needs of the poor and the marginalized. The reality is, as long as we think we live in a world with no God, we're going to try to be God. We're going to take, we're going to keep, we're going to own. It doesn't matter if it's someone else's. It doesn't matter if I got it from a paycheck. It's mine now. I keep it, and I do what I want with it. But God has given us this incredible way to just let go, to loosen that grip on other people's stuff, and even loosen our grip on the stuff he's given us in order that we might give it to others. He's given himself. He's given his son so that we could have a promise of paradise with him. One day you will inherit all things. You don't have to hold on to the things you have. You don't have to take time, money, copyright, anything else from someone else. Jesus has given you your ultimate need. God is a generous Father who will care for your needs in the future, whatever they are, and we're free simply to give it away. Let's pray.